it's kind of like drugs. You have the supply, which is coming from Wall Street. They're creating these financial drugs, basically. And then you have the demand, which is coming from the people that have all this income and wealth to invest.
That's Les Leopold. We'll spend most of the hour today talking with him about his latest book, The Looting of America.
We are dealing with these issues. We are putting in transparency. We are putting in accountability. We are also putting in some benefits for the average citizen.
And that's Representative Barney Frank. I talked with him back in September 08 when the Senate Finance Committee, which he chairs, was debating the bailout bill. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On July 16th, the New York Times reported, quote, a new order is emerging on Wall Street after the worst crisis since the Great Depression. The article pointed to soaring profits by Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. A few days later, Bank of America exceeded earnings expectations. Altogether, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, and Citigroup, the three biggest U.S. lenders, reported a total of $10.2 billion in profits for the second quarter. Wall Street loved it, now up more than 2,000 points from its February low. But something else is also going up, and that's the unemployment rate, now at its highest level in a generation, with 25 million out of work. What's going down is real wages, unless you're a CEO. The banks, for example, are taking a hefty slice out of their huge profits for big payouts to their executives. Is there a connection between big profits on Wall Street and continued suffering on Main Street? That's something my guest Les Leopold explores in his new book, The Looting of America. He argues the meltdown was caused by an income distribution that's wildly skewed. The ratio between the top CEO salaries and the bottom rung of workers' wages went from 40 to 1 in 1970 to almost 1,800 to 1 in 2006. That resulted in an excess of capital from the top, hungrily seeking outsized profits from speculation, what Leopold calls instruments of mass financial destruction, instead of investing in the real economy. Leopold says it's something like fantasy baseball, and when the season players, the banks, went on strike, the whole house of cards came tumbling down. Les Leopold, welcome to Writer's Voice. This is a terrific book, The Looting of America, and it's also a really great read, and it's the first thing I've read that actually explained all these derivatives, all these abstruse financial instruments of mass destruction in a really clear way.
Thank you. My purpose was to try to empower folks to feel like they could become citizens again in this, you know, rapidly moving financial discussion and debate. I noticed a lot of people are kind of intimidated by what's going on and, you know, are confused or they're angry, of course.
I want to start actually with morality. I want to start with the idea of a moral hazard. We heard a lot about moral hazard when the financial meltdown happened. J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs have emerged as mega titans of the financial industry after so many of their rivals have gone down. Tell us what moral hazard might have to do with this new development.
First, moral hazard is a sort of technical term that came out of the insurance industry, and it basically is when you can profit by taking a huge amount of risk knowing that someone's going to bail you out. So the way it's applied to the banking industry is that if you are too big to fail and too interconnected to fail, and you know it, and you know everybody else knows it, then you are likely to take a whole lot more risk to try to earn money because there's not much downside. You can make money on the way up, and if somehow things fail, you've got yours, and the taxpayer will come and take care of bailing you out of the risk because we can't afford to let the institution crash the whole system.
So now J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs have no incentive to rein in their risk. They've become too big to fail, even bigger than they were before. You know, a lot of people were very angry at the bailouts. I mean, not just people, let's say, ideologically driven on the right or the left. People in general, even some economists, said, well, you know, we should have let them fail. In your book, The Looting of America, you seem to say that, no, this, in fact, was necessary to do. That doesn't mean it was a good thing.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean it was done right either. But the idea of letting the entire financial sector implode, I think, was not possible. I mean, I think the notion that you could let these institutions fail and somehow the market would correct itself, well, maybe it would, but by the time it would have happened, there would have been 30-40%, you know, unemployed, because in a modern economy, finance is absolutely critical. And when financial markets freeze, it literally pushes the real economy of goods and services off a cliff. It makes it impossible to do business. So there was nothing particularly wrong or unusual going on in the real economy. I mean, you know, Chrysler and GM had problems, but they were not the kind that were going to crash the system. But when the financial system froze up, we saw auto sales go down globally by 40%. I mean, that's a big drop, because credit basically disappeared. And then you get into a downward spiral where people are laid off and they don't spend money, and that leads to more layoffs. And you get what's called a deflationary cycle, where people are holding off because they think prices are going to go down further, which leads to a further loss of employment. That's what happened in the Great Depression. And it's precipitated by a gigantic financial crash where nobody wants to loan money to anybody else because they're so afraid that the other institutions that they might loan it to will also go under. So I don't think we had a choice but to figure out how to keep the system from crashing. Now, whether we did it in the proper way and whether we're getting back what we should be getting back in return is a completely different kind of question.
And that's a question we're going to be devoting most of today, too. I'm speaking with Les Leopold. His book is The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity. So let's start back, way back in 1994. You talk about a James Bothwell. This was a guy who worked for the GAO, the Government Accountability Office. He testified before Congress about derivatives, and he gave them a warning about them. What was his warning to Congress?
Well, his warning basically was that it was very risky, that there were a few very large players that were setting up this casino, and that this casino, if one of the players had problems, the whole casino would crash and it could take down the entire financial system. He was more or less ignored, and others who followed him were laughed out of the room, because it was a general belief that free markets were self-correcting. As a matter of fact, we might want to go back just a little earlier, because what we're witnessing is the result of a grand experiment that began in the late 70s and early 1980s. And that grand experiment was, what would happen if we got rid of all the New Deal controls on finance, and if we changed the tax system so that money accumulated at the top? What was expected to happen was a gigantic investment boom. And that boom was going to lift all boats, and it was going to lead to a dramatic increase in the nation's wealth. That was the theory. And what happened, in fact, was that experiment didn't work out as expected. We got an enormous accumulation of wealth at the top, but the average wage did not go up. In fact, the average wage went down, the real wage after inflation. And what happened was, there was so much money accumulated at the top, and there was so little financial regulation, that the ability to set up very sophisticated casinos, basically what I call fantasy finance casinos, was set in motion. And there literally were not enough places in the real economy for all that wealth to be invested. So it started looking for riskier and riskier returns, and Wall Street was able to create those.
And they did through these incredibly sophisticated financial instruments. Could you just walk us through, what is a derivative?
The best way to understand a derivative is to think about fantasy sports. Let's take fantasy baseball. For your listeners who have no clue what that is, it's a a kind of gambling game where people pretend that they own real Major League Baseball players, and they get credit for real Major League Baseball player statistics, and they keep track of them, and then the team that has the most home runs or the most RBIs, that kind of stuff, ends up winning the pool of money that they put together. Now, there are only 700 real Major League Baseball players. There are only 30 baseball teams, real Major League Baseball teams. But there are over a million fantasy baseball teams that play as if they owned the real players. Now, they don't own anything. They just own the rights to get credited for what the real players do.
They're just betting, basically.
They're just betting. Now, a derivative is exactly that. A derivative is something that moves, like a fantasy baseball team, based on something else, an underlying real thing. In this case, there were a zillion kinds of derivatives that moved primarily based on risky debt, like subprime mortgages, credit cards, auto loans, things that were risky because risky things had higher interest rates. But here's the interesting problem. When you have a million fantasy baseball teams, you start getting an industry that's based around it. There are people who sell books. There are websites that cater to help keep track of all the statistics. There's all kinds of money that gets exchanged during this colossal amount of betting. But if the Major League Baseball players go on strike, then all those million teams are worthless. They can't play. They have no value. All the books that are written are useless. The stat services collapse. Everything disappears. Well, that's kind of what happened in the real economy, which is all these bets were based really on housing prices going higher and higher and higher. At some point, a limit was reached. They started to go down, and that was the equivalent of going on strike. And it crashed the value of not just the subprime mortgage securities, the real thing. It crashed layer after layer of fantasy finance derivatives based on the real thing. The impact was, you know, 5, 10, 20 times as great as if it were just the houses that went down.
And yet there was justification. There were justifications that were given to derivatives. Talk about Alan Greenspan. I mean, back when, you know, Bothwell was talking about the need to regulate these, he said regulating derivatives was a bad idea. Why did he say that? What were the guys who were, you know, as we know now, maybe drinking the Kool-Aid, what was their justification for this financial instrument?
Well, there was and is amongst many people this incredible almost theology that free markets are self-correcting, that all this betting was really taking place amongst very sophisticated players. And really what it was about was betting on risk. What a derivative allowed, the key derivative in all this, allowed the separating of the actual, let's say, stock or bond, but it's a bond really, a debt instrument, separating the actual debt instrument from the risk, that you could hold the debt instrument, but you could sell the risk to somebody else. And the theory was, well, the risk is going from someone who doesn't want it to someone who feels that they can handle it. So if this happens system-wide, if everybody's moving risk from people who can't handle it to people who can handle it, that's going to make the whole system safer. And that's what they thought was the beauty of this financial innovation, and that the free markets created the innovation and were distributing risk around the globe, making it less likely that there would be a crash. And some short-term evidence that Greenspan saw confirmed this. When Enron went under and WorldCom went under, the global economy did not crash. And people thought at the time it was because all the risk in the bonds had been sold and resold through these derivatives so many different ways that the risk was dispersed all around the globe so that nothing bad would happen to the system as a whole. Just turned out not to be the case. When so much risk was dispersed, what in fact happened was it increased the linkages around the globe so that when something significant underneath it all went bad, there was so much risky stuff out there that it all started to go south at the same time.
Well, tell us how this works. I mean, you know, a lot of people think it was a subprime mortgage market that got us into this mess. You know, conservatives say that it was because too many people were buying houses that they couldn't afford. But you point out that all the subprime mortgages didn't add up to more than $300 billion. Now, that seems like a lot of money, but, you know, after the crash, now we know that was a mere drop in the bucket. I mean, we're talking about multi-trillion dollars now that are in toxic assets. So tell us, how did these derivatives become so much more money? Talk about the tranches, and how did this system build upon itself?
Oh, dear. Let's start here. The easiest way to see it is, again, like fantasy baseball. In a sense, for every subprime mortgage that was repackaged and sold, there were several derivatives that were also sold. So that if one subprime mortgage, in effect, went down, it took down several other securities as
fantasy
well.
Fantasy mortgages, basically.
So that's how come you have trillions, three, four, five, six, we don't even know how many, trillions of toxic assets still littered around the globe because of this amplification process. The way they did it, the clever way they did it, was they did it so many different ways that it's actually really fascinating. But the simple concept was you take a gigantic pool of risky debt, and each month people who have the risky debt are able to still make their payments. Right now, over 82% of the subprime mortgages are still being paid. The default rate is only about 18%, 16 to 18%. So most people still pay. But if you imagine those payments going into like one big wine bottle, then what they did was they poured the wine into glasses in a certain order. And the glasses they filled first each month got AAA ratings and were seemed safe as can be, and then the last ones they filled were really risky because you might run out of wine when you get down to that bottom 12, 13, 14, 18% that's not there anymore.
So in other words, people who were not willing to take a lot of risk bought these slices of mortgages, these tranches, got a lower rate of return, but got assured that they were safer. Then there was the middle rung, you know, where you got a little bit higher return, a little less safety. And then there were the people who's basically, you liken them to junk bonds.
Oh, they're worse than junk bonds. But here was the miracle of the whole process. All the securities that were cut up got a higher rate of return than you could get in a normal corporate bond, or definitely more than in a federal note or bond. And that's why the money rushed towards it. See, to deal with that housing question that you started with here, I think the best way to see it is when there was that enormous amount of money in the hands of a few at the top rushing around the globe, and I'm talking about an enormous amount of money. I'm talking, you know, trillions, literally trillions, that was looking for investment opportunities. It was hungry for slightly better returns, so it bought into this risky debt stuff. That's what made the money available for the subprime boom in housing. Banks were begging for subprime mortgages because they wanted to pool them and sell them. So the push for subprime didn't come from low-income home buyers or speculators. The push came from the banks that said, look, sell me the loans as fast as you can, and we're going to give you money to loan it out again. And we don't really care who you loan it to, because as long as it's risky debt, we can package it and sell it, because there's so many people out there who want to buy it. Let me just give your listeners a sense of how much money rushed to the top. We did this little study of the top 100 CEOs and compared their wages to the average worker in 1970. The ratio was 40 to 1. $1 for the average worker, 40 for the top 100 CEOs. By 2006, the ratio was 1,723 to 1. From 40 to 1 to 1,723 to 1.
Wow.
That's quite a change. Here's another one. In 2006, which is the latest tax data that we've had to analyze, the top one-tenth of 1% of all tax returns had as much income as the bottom 50%. Now, the last time we had that skewed income distribution was 1928, 1929.
Right.
It's not an accident.
And what you're saying here is basically that there is a huge amount of excess capital that's looking for a place to invest.
Correct. And Wall Street is very inventive. And they created these fantasy finance instruments because they could sell them. And that, in turn, led to more and more housing. This particular bubble was a housing bubble, led to more and more money being available for housing to keep the conveyor belt of risky debt going so they could meet this enormous demand. It's kind of like drugs. You have the supply, which is coming from Wall Street. They're creating these fantasy financial drugs, basically. And then you have the demand, which is coming from people that have all this income and wealth to invest. You can try to do whatever you can to stop the demand, I mean the supply, but if the demand's there, the supply will reappear. It's like why the war on drugs doesn't work, right? Because as long as people want drugs, somehow they're going to get it.
Right.
If it's not legal, you're going to get it illegally. In this case, you know, you can regulate Wall Street all you want, but if you don't do something about the distribution of the income, the demand for fantasy finance products will always be there, and Wall Street will find a way to create it.
Well, you know, I want to come back to that point, but I think I'd like to go through some of the way this unfolded first.
Sure.
Now, you have talked about these risky assets, but supposedly a lot of these assets, these collateralized debt obligations, which are what were some of these securitized subprime mortgages went into, supposedly some of them were safe. They got AAA ratings. Now, just in the news recently, as we are doing this interview, CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement System, which, like many pension systems, had to invest in supposedly secure, safe financial investments, just announced a suit against the three major ratings agencies, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch. They charged that the AAA ratings given by the agencies proved to be wildly inaccurate and unreasonably high. So tell us, how did these instruments that were supposed to be safe come out to be so unsafe? And why did Moody's and Fitch and Standard & Poor's, why did they drink the Kool-Aid?
Oh, they did more than drink the Kool-Aid. They pocketed the money. I mean, what you have to always keep in mind here is that all of this is about trying to get money, get your piece. These securities that were being created, the fantasy finance instruments, were incredibly valuable because there were a lot of fees embedded in them. And those fees were the most lucrative items that Wall Street had ever come upon in the history of Wall Street. So they wanted to sell these things. And Moody's wanted to rate them because they got nice fees for rating them. In fact, they even got involved in helping to create them. The CalPERS one is incredible because they bought a AAA rated bond in which they were not permitted to find out what was in the package. They couldn't find out what was even securitized because that was quote unquote proprietary information. And Moody's gets paid $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 or more, up to $1 million, for helping to create the package, and then they get another $50,000 or $100,000 for rating it. And Moody's itself was the most profitable firm in terms of return for 5 years, the last 5 years running, from 2002 to 2007. So this was an incredibly lucrative business. So, you know, you leave it to private enterprise to police itself through this rating system, and, you know, you get what you pay for, which is they're going to rate it in a way that makes it work for them.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Les Leopold about the financial meltdown and the looting of America. That's the name of his newest book, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity. Now, GM, General Motors, has just whizzed through bankruptcy. Who knew, you know, 2 months ago that they would go into Chapter 11 and then get out of bankruptcy so quickly? How do you read this within the context of what you've just talked about, in fact, and this huge transfer of wealth upward to the very, very tiniest percent of Americans and away from the rest of us?
The way I view this is, you know, I see this long-run trend where we've allowed, A, wealth to accumulate at the top, and B, for it to go gushing into these Wall Street fantasy finance instruments. And the real economy has suffered dramatically over a long period of time. All workers have not gotten the fruits of their labor the way they had in the 1950s and 60s. I thought one of the most fascinating things that we worked on for the book was tracking the way wages and productivity is the output per worker hour, which is really the best measure of a nation's wealth. Those two numbers went up together from World War II to the mid-1970s every single year. The correlation was so tight that there's no way you couldn't see them as connected. And the standard of living of the average working person really did improve in the 50s and 60s and through the middle of the 70s. And then the experiment started that we talked about earlier, the deregulation and the transfer of wealth to the top, and the two lines separated. And average wages went flat and then down, but productivity kept going up. It's gone up 90% since the mid-1970s, and the average real wage, instead of going up 90%, went down 18%. So the gap between those lines is a huge amount of money, and that's the money that's floating around at the top. The GM problem just exacerbates it because those were the better jobs. Those were jobs that helped pull up the average wage, right? Those were unionized jobs with decent benefits. So what's going to happen now is the downward pressure on wages is getting even greater. The gap is going to get larger.
But recently, you know, when GM went through this bankruptcy, there were a whole lot of groups, for example, GM pensioners, people who had been promised certain things by GM, which are now not happening. And you have a part in the book where you talk about GM. And maybe this isn't related to this or not, but you talk about the bets that were made on whether GM bonds would sink into default or swim.
Yeah, you know what? That's the one section, or the one line in the book that we're actually going to change in the next edition that comes out. Because I thought there would be a calamity in terms of all the bond betting that was going on if GM went under. But it doesn't seem to have happened.
And why not?
Because the bets were fairly balanced. The winners and losers kind of canceled each other out, and there weren't any big institutions that sunk as a result of it.
With Chapter 11? Because there, you know...
In other words, there wasn't a daisy chain of...
Gotcha.
...of Chapter 11 things. That GM went under, and then these banks that bet on them went under, and then the banks that bet on the banks went under. That didn't happen.
Right, but what has happened is that courts are not allowing people to actually sue GM for, you know, the broken promises, basically.
That problem that you're now putting your finger on, actually, that has to do with the whole way that we've shaped benefits since World War II. The United Automobile Workers was at first a leading force in national health care in 1948, and the idea of pensions that would be universal for everybody, travel with you when you go from job to job, health care that goes with you from job to job. In a way, the labor movement gave up on that, didn't think they could win it. So they started concentrating on getting it from their employer. And they never believed that their employers would ever disappear. They thought for sure the United States would continue to support its key industries. Well, it turned out that's not true. Turns out while other countries may support their key industries, we have no industrial policy. We're the ones that allow anything to happen. And so these plants have been exported overseas for years now. When I got into started getting involved in my nonprofit work in the mid-1970s, the United Automobile Workers was this gigantic union, a leader of progressive causes. There were 360,000 GM workers in the United States. There's like 20, 40,000 now, and the automobile workers, you know, are in trouble. And a lot of this has to do with our lack of a genuine social wage package, true national health care, a true pension system that you can take with you wherever you go, and no industrial policy that allows decent-paying jobs to be created and developed in the United States. We just exported them, and we're going to be paying that price for a long, long time.
Yeah, exactly. Les Leopold. His book is The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. It's out from Chelsea Green. Stay tuned for more of our interview after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today about the roots of the financial crisis with author Les Leopold. His book is The Looting of America. The Federal Reserve is more powerful now than at any other time in its history. Some are questioning its capacity to protect the economy from future financial meltdowns. More than 250 lawmakers are supporting a bill to allow the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, to audit the Fed's decisions on monetary policy. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is fiercely opposing it. Bernanke is an expert in the history of the Great Depression, but Les Leopold thinks he's drawn the wrong lessons from it. Now, Ben Bernanke, as you point out in your book, The Looting of America, you point out he's a scholar of the Great Depression.
Yep.
What's his theory of that collapse, and how has it informed what he's doing now?
The theory of the Great Depression that Ben Bernanke works off of, because he studied it, that's both his academic area and his hobby, was that it was really a problem of bad policy by the Fed after the crash. That it was a financial crash, yes, we all agree on that, but there was nothing very much wrong in the system as a whole, assuming that the Fed added money to the system, added what they call liquidity, so that money would be easy to get and invest by banks, and it would prop up the system. What happened then there were a lot of moves that were just the opposite. There was a tightening of credit, says Bernanke. There was a trying to maintain the gold standard and a whole bunch of things that tightened money and made it very scarce and drove thousands and thousands of banks out of business and caused, in his mind, the Great Depression. So what he's doing now is he's pumping money into the system every way that he can. He is using the Fed to move more and more cash everywhere into the banking system, so that kind of collapse doesn't happen.
And is it working?
I think it actually is. Whether it's enough depends on what's really causing the problem. I think it's preventing a huge set of banks collapsing. Look, there are a lot of things in place now that were not in place during the Great Depression. As much as the free marketeers wanted to destroy the New Deal, they didn't get rid of the federal deposit insurance, they didn't get rid of the ability to take over banks and prevent bank runs. So those things are in place, and they're working. Putting more money into the system is better than not putting more money into the system. I wish it were put in the hands of the average person as opposed to the banks. I think that would work better. But it's a question now of whether that's enough. If Bernanke's theory is correct, it's going to work out. But it doesn't look like it's enough. That's why we had a stimulus package of $787 billion, and that doesn't look like it's enough. So I'm not sure we're out of the woods here.
So that comes back to what you were talking about in terms of too much capital sloshing around, really the idea that the real economy is not being supported, workers' wages are not being supported. In your book, Les Leopold, The Looting of America, you talk about the problem of the unions, and you just mentioned the UAW. Now, the card check provision just got stripped out of the Employee Free Choice Act. This was legislation that the unions were really, really pushing in their support for the Democrats in this most recent presidential and senatorial election. And this was a provision so central to that act that it was, in fact, called the card check bill. Could you talk about how important something like this is in terms of being able to prevent future meltdowns?
Okay. First of all, I think we have to get a sense of the enormity of where we still are. Right now, the real unemployment rate, when you count the jobless rate, when you count people who have stopped looking for work and people who are sort of imprisoned in part-time jobs where they want full-time jobs, the shortfall of jobs is something like 25 million jobs right now and rising. 25 million. The unemployment rate, using this broader measure, is approaching 20% and is over 20% in several states already. So we're talking about a lot of people that are unemployed. And they're not going to get employed again until there's a real growth in the real economy, both in the public and in the private sector. The fiscal crisis in the various states, again caused by the financial crash, is like a headwind into whatever the stimulus is doing. Because if you're laying off teachers and hiring construction workers, it doesn't kind of make sense. So there's a huge shortfall there. There are two things we have to do to kind of solve this problem in the long run. One is we've got to move money from Wall Street into the real economy. We can talk about that later. But the other is we've got to move money from the top of the income scale to the middle and the bottom. And there are various things that have to be done. No matter what you think about unions, no matter what you think about, you know, low-income workers, no matter what you think about morality, from an economic point of view, we got to close the gap and get it more like it was in the 60s and the 50s. And one key piece of that, there's really two key pieces of that. One is raising the minimum wage and indexing it to inflation. Right now, the real value of the minimum wage is below what it was in the 1970s. And that makes a huge difference on all wages. If you can raise the bottom, you almost automatically raise the rest of the income scale. The other thing is you need to make it easier for people to get in unions. One of the things that happened as part of this experiment starting in the mid-70s onward was it became much more difficult for people to organize unions, not because workers didn't want to join unions or they thought they were corrupt or all that kind of garbage. It actually was much more difficult. The labor law got twisted more and more towards the employer, and it became very expensive and very time-consuming to form a union. And if you tried to form a union, you could lose your job, you could be out for a long, long time, and it would take years for you to be able to ever get your compensation back, assuming you could win a case in court. So it was a very, very bad scene, and it's still a bad scene. The car checkoff bill would have been probably the best way to have it in Canada. It would have been the best way to spread unions in order to close that wage gap. And that would have been a good thing economically. No matter what you think of unions, you want to see those wages go up. And it's not clear to me that what's left of that bill, you know, there's some provisions that are still good that are left, but we'll see whether it leads to some dramatic increase in unionization. But we sure need it. Back when the economy was booming, one out of three workers was in a union, private sector worker.
So you're actually saying
that was one out of 12.
You're saying that the more people are in unions, the more prosperous the whole economy is?
Yeah, because you know, this was the lesson of the Great Depression. That was a consensus position amongst, you know, policymakers and almost all thoughtful people during the 30s and 40s. They understood that when workers' wages went up and the wealthy didn't have as much money to play with, you had a more stable system. And you had more buying power. Working people would spend their money. Yeah, they may gamble in Atlantic City and, you know, Vegas, but they don't buy, you know, synthetic collateralized debt obligations on Wall Street. They don't do the kinds of things that cause systemic risk. So that was understood. So a low gap between the super wealthy and everyone else was something that people felt good about. It's not an accident that the marginal tax rate in the 1950s was 90%. In other words, if you had $1 million, the next dollar you earned turned into 10 cents. 90% was taxed away. That wasn't an accident. That was because people understood that your economy would be at risk if you let extremes in wealth distribution take place. And, you know, they were right. We thought we were smarter. You know, the economy wasn't booming as much as we thought by the mid-70s. We had, you know, Jimmy Carter's malaise. We had stagflation. We had all kinds of problems. So they thought, you know what? This is a whole bunch of malarkey, this New Deal stuff. We're going to let it rip. Well, we let it rip, and, you know, it took about 30 years. And 30 years later, we walked right up to the Great Depression.
So why did that policy begin to falter in the 1970s?
I think the fundamental, the world was changing. You know, Europe and Japan were back on their feet again. We were screwing up our own wealth by propagating the Cold War and the Vietnam War. In other words, we're pouring dollars overseas to finance the Vietnam War, to operate bases all over the world. And we started to basically devalue our currency, and other nations got very upset about that because they were holding a lot of currency, so they jacked up their prices. So you had some temporary chaos. But the solution to the temporary chaos was not to move money to the super rich. The solution was to have a more stable trade regime, which in fact, we didn't do. We went the other way. We went towards rapid globalization, and we're going to pay the price for that, too. Our industry got exported.
So tell us, you said we need to move more money into the real economy.
Right.
How are we going to do that?
We got
to
make
now?
Banking on Wall Street boring and where you can't get filthy rich. The best way to do that is an across-the-board wage cap, compensation cap on all financial employees, because the whole sector is on welfare right now. It would have collapsed had we not poured in trillions of dollars. A woman named Nomi Prinz, who used to work at Goldman Sachs, has put together an excellent chart of all the different subsidies that we've now given Wall Street in terms of guarantees, TARP money, all kinds of things. It adds up to $13.1 trillion. So we have a right, we own them. It may be, they may think they're still privately run, but this is the perfect opportunity to just say, guess what? You're under we're instituting what I call the president's wage cap. Nobody gets more than $400,000 a year. Nobody can earn more than the president of the United States. You can't live on that. Go work somewhere else. We want to shrink the size. And Obama said this. I just wish he would do it. You want to shrink the size of Wall Street. You want to discourage all this talent from going in there to create new fantasy finance casino games. You want to have it get into the real economy. So that's one thing. That would have a huge impact. Two, we need a very small transaction tax on each and every financial transaction. Every time you sell a bond, a stock, a derivative, whatever, ka-ching, money goes into the federal treasury. That would increase the cost of a lot of these risky transactions, first of all. You know, you think twice about zinging trillions of dollars around the world in a matter of seconds because it would cost you some money. Over time, over a year's time, somewhere between 50 and 500 billion would go into the federal treasury. There's a bill in Congress right now by a guy named Representative Peter DeFazio from Oregon, which is more or less like this. He wants us to pay us back for TARP, but I think, you know, that's too minimal a goal. But he's already put forward such a transaction tax idea. That's a good idea because it moves money out of Wall Street into our coffers to be able to support investments in infrastructure, alternative energy, healthcare, et cetera. The other thing, I think that these outlandish profits that are now coming out from Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan that you started this show on, talking about, that money is our money. If there were no subsidies, they would be howling. Matter of fact, if we didn't save AIG, both those firms would probably go into bankruptcy because they would have been, they were so dependent on the credit insurance that they bought from AIG, which AIG couldn't pay. But they now got 100% on the dollar, 100 cents on a dollar for those insurance policies, and it's to the tune of like, you know, $13 billion. So it's not hard to make a profit when we just gave them $13 billion at Goldman Sachs. We should have a windfall profits tax. 90% of their profits, just like under the Eisenhower administration, 90% should be immediately taxed away so we can start paying ourselves back.
A lot of people say that regulation won't work. What's different about what you're proposing?
If all we do is try to set up, you know, minor regulations to kind of set up maybe better exchanges for derivatives and we're going to watch them a little more closely, I don't think that will work. What I'm talking about, these aren't regulations. These are massive changes in the structure of finance on Wall Street. I mean, $400,000 for a lot of these folks there, that's not enough to tip their limo drivers, pay their condo fees. That's a ridiculously low amount to them. They're used to 10, 20, 30 million a year.
And you're referring to?
I'm referring to the people that create and sell fantasy finance derivatives.
No, I mean the $400,000?
Yeah, the $400,000 is peanuts to them. That would be my president's wage cap.
Right.
So if we had that kind of cap, it would that's not a regulation. That's a revolution in how Wall Street does business. And the thing is that right now, the American public would go for it. They think it's see, they didn't really know how Wall Street paid itself. They didn't realize that these folks were making money by running a casino. Nobody's paying back the money they made by selling all this junk. There was $300 billion the nine biggest banks made, $300 billion before the crash. Since then, they lost $300 billion, but we've paid that. They haven't paid that. It's not like somebody went to their Swiss account and said, okay, I'm sorry, I'm going to give you back $50 million. Nobody's given back any money. So we need to get it back going forward now. And the way to do that is a wage cap, a transaction tax, and a windfall profit tax. I think those three things would go a long way. Then if you want to do other regulations on, you know, I think it would be a good idea to have a Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which ironically the banks are using our money as lobbying money to lobby against a financial consumer protection agency. And I can't possibly imagine what the logic is. That's the agency is to sort of make sure that people don't get screwed by unscrupulous mortgage brokers, you know, to try to actually control the financial instruments that consumers buy so they don't end up getting into mortgages they don't understand. You know, it makes a lot of sense, right? All I can think of is they think that somehow it's an American constitutional right to be able to be fleeced by the mortgage broker of your choice. I don't know what other logic there is here. But they're using, they're literally, they said, I can't believe they said this, they said, we're going to give it all we've got to beat that bill. I'm thinking, all you've got? You don't have anything that we didn't just give you in the last 9 months. You were dead and gone. We propped you up because we had to. Now you're using that income to come after something that's going to protect the consumer. Yeah, we need to do all that stuff, but if we don't do the big things, it's not going to mean enough.
Well, your book, and it's an eminently readable book, The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity. Les Leopold, it's been great talking with you. This is a wonderful book to read.
Well, thank you, and you're a terrific interviewer, so it's my pleasure.
We first talked with Les Leopold in December of 2007 about his biography of labor leader Tony Mazzocchi. It's called The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor. You can listen to that interview by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Barney Frank. Let's go back in time, listeners, way back to September of 2008. I interviewed Congressman Barney Frank then for the other radio show I produce with Bill Bowie called Sea Change Radio. Bill and I talked with Frank just 5 days before the House Financial Services Committee, which he chairs, submitted the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, otherwise known as the bailout bill, to the full House. It eventually became law with some changes. 10 months have passed, so let's first listen up and then we'll look at some of what actually has happened. Bill Bowie asked the first question.
The bailout exhibits many of the same characteristics as the free market fundamentalism that got us into this mess, such as lack of transparency and accountability, blind faith in rising value, and corporate enrichment for success and failure. First, there's the question of value for the assets being bailed out. It's been leaked that Paulson plans to buy the assets at more than their value. You've said that the assets will eventually rise in value, but there's no guarantee, and nobody even knows how to value these assets. What's more, the Treasury is printing cash to pay for it, leading to further dollar devaluation. How does TARP guard the value in taxpayer money?
One, we are going to be urging them to do some reverse auctions. Two, and I want to go to your transparency accountability.
That's our next question, yes.
Well, I'm going to answer it now because it's related, because it's how we deal with this. The bill they sent in had just the Secretary do whatever he wanted. We have no intention of passing anything like that. We have already written language, and we've told them it's going to be in there, which is going to set up an independent oversight board appointed by the leadership of Congress with its own staff and budget. There'll be regular reports, but each transaction as it's done will be reported to them. So that's one of the ways in which you fix on the price. The world will see what price they are paying, and if it is a consensus that they're paying too much, we will be able to put pressure on them to stop it. And in fact, I think the fact that the amount that they're paying will be revealed will be a significant constraint. Secondly, there is a reverse auction mechanism, which means that they will be buying things that are offered to them at the cheapest level. So those are the two major safeguards. And finally, we are talking about buying some shares. But in the case of buying shares, you've got a price there. And we are also saying, though, that if we buy shares, we will be getting warrants so that over and above the dividends or whatever the shares would get, they would be preferred shares, we will have a participation so that if the company then profits, the federal government gets a share of that profit.
Well, I want to ask about a different kind of accountability. What's a quid pro quo? I mean, when an ordinary person declares bankruptcy, it's a painful process. They have high fees, high barriers to file.
Here's what we have in there. First of all, we do want to amend the law. In our bill, it will include the right of the individual to declare bankruptcy with regard to his or her primary residence. That's been an important goal for people concerned about diminishing foreclosures. That was frustrated when we couldn't get it through the Senate. There was a lot of conservative opposition. So we will put into this bill the language we had developed in the House Judiciary Committee so that you can now declare bankruptcy on your primary residence. That's an important way to help get interest down and help avoid foreclosure.
But my question is, why are these Wall Street, the same people who brought us this crisis, possibly being rewarded with millions of dollars in contracts to go through with this bailout rather than being punished, basically, so that these kinds of situations don't happen?
Well, in terms of punishment, we don't control the executive branch. We hope there will be punishment. But I am trying to answer your question. You asked me specifically not whether they would be punished, but what benefit there would be for the individuals, in part, I thought.
No, actually, my question was about lack of accountability for these guys. Why? What is going to be put in place
to accountability? Mm-hmm. First of all, limits on compensation for the first time ever legislated. Anybody who participates in this, there will be several limits on the compensation. Secondly, greater accountability for the corporations by overturning the SEC's rulings that have blocked proxy access. That's an important thing that pension funds and shareholder reform groups have wanted, the right to be able to put nominees for the boards of directors on the boards. So those are two of the things we'll do. As far as accountability for past mistakes, you don't legislate those. I wish we had an administration that was more willing to do some prosecution. Speaker Pelosi has asked Henry Waxman, the chairman of the Oversight Committee, to begin hearings, which he's starting, I think, this week with Richard Fuld from Lehman, to go into who did what wrong and to go after them on that. But in terms of what we can do going forward, if you participate in this, you will get a requirement that you allow proxies to make a Democratic election for the board of directors within the shareholder democracy.
Well, Representative Frank, the say on pay and the proxy access are great additions to this, but those are sort of going forward. How about going backward and
clawbacks?
Well, you cannot
go backward legislatively. Legislation has to be forward-looking. You cannot, by the principles against retroactivity in the Constitution and American law, legislate backwards. You can get administrative activity to deal with it. Now, part of the problem, of course, is that we haven't had sufficient laws on the books. This deregulatory philosophy that has prevailed for so long has meant that, unfortunately, some of these things weren't against the law that should have been. The best we can do in a bill, and you got to understand the distinction between legislation and administrative action, the best we can do legislatively is to put the rules in place so that these will be violations going forward.
Representative Frank, you're saying that these haven't been on the table or haven't been in the law. You've been the head of the House Financial Services Committee for the last 2 years. What is it that you have done and what have you not done to make sure...
Well, I'm surprised, frankly, that you're so interested in this that you don't know more about it. In fact, Say on Pay passed the House last year. Our committee voted it. Say on Pay, in particular, the House passed a bill to mandate it. Mandate that there be a shareholder vote on compensation, and it was unfortunately held up in the Senate. And it is true. I became the chairman a year and a half ago. We've done other things. Last year, we passed a bill to ban the kind of abusive subprime loans that have been problematic. We also passed a bill that the Republicans hadn't been able to do in 12 years, significantly to improve the regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The House passed that in May of 2007. The Senate, unfortunately, didn't get around to it until July. So in those three areas, increasing the regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Say on Pay, we did act, and restricting abusive subprime loans. You know, there's a big agenda. You can't do it all in 1 year.
Now, Representative Frank, there are parallels being drawn with the Resolution Trust Corporation from the late 1990s.
Not very good ones. It's a very different entity.
Can you explain how it's different? And that would be very helpful.
Yes, very simply. First of all, the Resolution Trust Corporation stepped in after savings and loans or other thrift institutions had failed. So there was no discretion about who you dealt with or not. Secondly, they had real physical assets. The Resolution Trust Corporation owned buildings and was selling buildings. That's very different than dealing with institutions where you hope they won't be failing and where you were dealing with investments and securities rather than physical buildings.
But some people have said, well, why step in? Why not let see who is, in fact, going to fail? Why not let the market work? And why rush this through so quickly?
Well, two questions. One, I know there are some extreme free market conservatives who say let the market work. What they're saying, of course, is let the pain happen because people will learn from it. For example, that means auto loans will probably stop getting made. If people can't get loans, automobile sales drop off. Auto workers get hurt. People who work in the showrooms of automobile dealers get hurt. Credit is very important. Now, it is a shame that this extreme deregulatory philosophy that I've criticized, but until recently didn't have the chance to fight against in an effective way, has prevailed, and they've been able to do these mistakes. But they have put the economy at risk. And what we're talking about is not Wall Street, but credit.
I asked Barney Frank whether the House Financial Services Committee was perhaps rushing too fast in creating the bill before the ramifications could be more carefully considered.
It's not a question of time that leads to this kind of legislation. We are dealing with these issues. We are putting in transparency. We are putting in accountability. We are also putting in some benefits for the average citizen. One of the things we are able to do here, and we are still worried about people being foreclosed upon in ways that are bad for them, bad for their neighborhoods, and bad for the economy. We are using this opportunity to say to the administration, if you want this, you're also going to have to accept significant legislation that will allow people to avoid foreclosure in very large numbers.
Congressman Barney Frank of the House Financial Services Committee talking about the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. Let's see what the TARP did or didn't do. According to a report from the Treasury Department, the Financial Stability Oversight Board, which was written into the TARP, has overall helped mortgage borrowers by increasing liquidity in the mortgage market. On the other hand, mortgage foreclosures continue to soar, spreading beyond the subprime mortgage sector as unemployment rises. So the significant foreclosure protection Barney Frank mentioned hasn't worked out so well. Let's look at limits on executive compensation. The TARP didn't end up doing a whole lot to control executive pay, but the stimulus bill which came after it did put some limits on bonuses for firms that accepted bailout money. But it only applies before those firms have paid the U.S. government back for the taxpayer funds they received. Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan paid back their bailout money to avoid having to conform to limits on pay, with Goldman Sachs set to give out the biggest bonuses in the firm's 140-year history. Finally, how much are the paybacks really worth? The U.S. Treasury says the true value of the warrants being paid back can't really be determined. That's raised concerns that the government is getting less than it's owed. You can find out more about these and other issues with the TARP by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.